is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to Cameron Pasha. He's the author of a new novel called Shadow of the Swords. It has a subtitle, An Epic Novel of the Crusades, and it definitely is epic. Thanks for talking to me today, Cameron.
Thank you, David. I'm very excited to be here.
This is your second book. The first one was called Mother of the Believers, which I think, as you told me, and as I've read online, was about a fictionalized version of the life of Muhammad's daughter, Aisha?
His wife.
But it was a young wife.
She was a young woman in her teens.
Right. And so, you kind of have begun to establish a turf for yourself, I think, in this historical realm, writing about this historical period of the Muslim religion. I thought, definitely was very interesting to the way you presented this particular novel, which is about the Crusades, particularly Richard the Lionheart's arrival in Palestine to fight for the possession of Jerusalem, which Saladin, the great leader of, who I didn't realize was Kurdish, who had commanded an army of Muslim soldiers and had taken over Jerusalem from the prior invaders.
Sure.
So it's a pretty, it is epic. It covers a period in history which many people will be familiar with, primarily maybe from Shakespeare and from the British side of history.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about how you were trying to do here in terms of presenting these major figures as human beings, which I think you did quite well.
Thank you. Well, this particular book, Shadow of the Swords, my intention had been to focus on figures that are very familiar to the West, but show them from another point of view. Specifically, Richard the Lionheart, in many ways, has been, if I can use the phrase, lionized in Western history and really in Western mythology. We even associate him with the heroic king that backs Robin Hood, all of these kinds of legends. Whereas in the Muslim world and also in Jewish history and memory, he's really seen as a villainous figure who was an aggressive invader who attacked Jerusalem, who attacked the Holy Land, and killed thousands of people. So it was really always fascinating to me, being a Muslim raised in America, having my own cultural, historical sense of this personage versus the vision that I was being taught in America. So I thought, maybe I can write a novel telling the story of the Crusades from the Muslim and the Jewish point of view, which we really haven't heard. There's a lot of wonderful books out there about the Plantagenet dynasty, about the Crusades, about the Knights Templar, that are told almost exclusively from the European and the Western perspective. And many of them are quite good. Many of them are fair to the Muslims. Many of them ignore the Jewish presence in the region and Muslim-Jewish relations at the time. So I thought we really want to look at those issues in this book.
Well, and I thought that was really, quite powerful for me. That you presented really the three religions that are involved in the history of Jerusalem, really in the history of the world, focused on that area for so many thousands of years. And of course, you highlight the fact that Muslim religion honors, or at least should honor, as you call them, the people of the book, who are the Jews, and from whom both Christianity and the Muslim religion derive. And I thought that was very, I thought it was really interesting to demonstrate that even though there were many tensions between Jews and Muslims, Saladin in particular valued and cared for and protected Jews in his territory. And in particular, in your novel, of course, you have individuals who stand out. You've got Maimonides, who was his advisor and physician. And now, some of the things that happened, I guess I wanted to ask you in particular, we don't have to tell the whole story.
We'll keep a few secrets.
In one particular key scene, Richard becomes ill, and he's seriously ill and really on the verge of death. And in fact, the local commander who fancies himself the king of Jerusalem, who is an Italian ultimately, is quite happy to see Richard potentially dying. And what Saladin, Sir William, who is Richard's literally right-hand man at that point, puts his life in his hand in at risk, and rides to Saladin to ask for Maimonides to come and heal Richard. Now, was that based on, I mean, did you make that up?
No, I mean, that's based on a historical incident. I don't believe it was Maimonides himself who was the doctor that arrived. I don't believe the doctor is identified in history. But the historical incident of Saladin sending a doctor to save Richard's life is recorded in the historical accounts by both Crusaders and the Muslim accounts. And, you know, the Crusaders were quite shocked by this. This was really their first interaction directly with Saladin. I mean, these soldiers had arrived from Europe with all kinds of stories, all kinds of propaganda about what they were going to face, and Saladin was portrayed as this servant of Satan, this evil demonic force that had taken Jerusalem from the people of God. And so when they arrive there, their very first interaction with him is their king gets sick, and he sends a personal doctor there to heal him and save his life. And that shook them up a little bit. And over the course of the next several years, the next 2 to 3 years of conflict in the area of the Third Crusade, many of Richard's men were really startled and really were forced to take a second look as Saladin consistently showed this kind of chivalry and honor that was part of his character. And it really, in many ways, disgruntled his army. And I think much of the morale that Richard was trying to desperately keep going was affected by the fact that people were saying, okay, this guy who you've told us is our adversary and our enemy and our villain, he doesn't seem to be acting that way. And so that was really, it was something that stayed with the Crusaders. And they would write about Saladin, you know, in their mind that all the Saracens and all the Arabs and Muslims were evil, but Saladin was special. Whereas in reality, Saladin saw himself as being preserving, as being a manifestation or preserving the values of the culture, especially at a time he knew that his adversary didn't know what the Muslims were about. He thought it was very important to show that we are people of honor. You've been told we're not. So maybe you should think about why you're fighting us.
Well, and of course, what you present there between, and not just Saladin, his some of his lieutenants and the people that are on his side are equally willing and able to cast the Crusaders as villainous, evil, and wrong.
Sure.
And so, you know, this is sort of typical of how wars begin and are sustained in our history, in the history of humanity, that you have to make the other non-human.
Oh,
in order for you to sustain your force, and in order to maintain this idea, so that the brutality and horror of war is justifiable. So you turn the enemy into, as you said, you know, as you put it in the novel, the Crusaders treat the Muslims as infidels, and you can kill an infidel. And actually, in Muslim religion, as you presented, and I think this is accurate, the notion was that if someone professed on the spot of, you know, even in the face of death, professed to accept the Muslim religion, they would have to be spared.
Yes, I mean that's throughout Muslim history. I mean that's, you know, granted, from our 21st century post Enlightenment values, even that is, you know, people shouldn't be judged on the basis of religion. But Islam has always had the rule that even someone who is in battle and facing you, if conversion to Islam is very simple. It's just a statement of one sentence that there is only one God and Muhammad is his prophet. And when you state that out loud, then you are considered a Muslim by the community. And so even in battle, the rule has always been if the adversary makes a profession of faith out loud, you can't fight him any further.
Right, which but of course, as you point out, even in the 11th century, that was not being fully honor.
Oh, of course not, because, you know, these are ideals. And, you know, what I didn't want to do in this book is try to present perfect Muslims versus evil Europeans.
Right.
And I didn't want to do that. And I actually, in some ways, one of the criticisms I get from some people who read the book is that Saladin is portrayed in both the Crusader and in Muslim histories as a very saintly figure. He's portrayed as this very rare sort of saintly king, and his flaws really aren't discussed in the historical record. And so I give him flaws. I mean, I keep the historical record of his honor and his sense of justice and compassion, but I give him human feelings and emotions and ethical things he's dealing with and personal flaws.
Right, well, that's why you've created it's a novel, it's not propaganda,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you've created complexity, and you know that even though the historical record may paint him as perfect, mm-hmm. that's typically what has always happened with leaders upon their death. You know, that then they become celebrated for somebody that they really aren't. So I thought that was really, I think it was important that your characters are characters. They're complex. They're not simple. They're not stick figures. So, you know, that it went, as you said, that you didn't want to present one side as good and the other side as bad.
Well, I don't believe that. I believe we're human beings, and we're acting based on our life experiences and the information that we have. And even with Richard, who really is the antagonist of this book and really not the hero of the book, even he goes, in my novel, on a personal journey of growth where he begins to come to terms with, okay, well, why am I here? Why am I doing these things? You know, there is a moment in the novel, which is fictional, but which feels intuitively true to me. And my Christian friends who've read the book have really responded to this moment, where during that time when Richard is dying and Saladin has sent Maimonides to heal him, I create a fictional dream sequence where he sees the horrors of the war he's about to engage upon, and he actually has a confrontation with Christ on the cross. And they have a really intense discussion of what it means to be Christian. And it shakes Richard up. It makes him ask questions. I mean, am I doing this for Christ or am I doing this for myself?
Right. I thought that was actually really an important theme in the book, because it provided a kind of recognition of the complexity of the
mm-hmm.
sort of psychological persona.
Mm-hmm.
I think for many of us, when we think about history, we really do think about acting, actors,
mm-hmm.
that people are doing things. And we have this feeling, and of course it is partly true that the 20th century created the psychological realm, and that, you know, we don't know how deeply psychologically aware on a kind of conscious level, you know, human beings were in the, you know, 1500 years ago or 1000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But the myths and kind of stories that people tell reveal psychological and a kind of spiritual conflict, which I thought your dream was very accurate in portraying, that, you know, he would be troubled by what he saw, not understanding fully the imagery that he was being faced with, and really not even accepting what the dream was telling him.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really, really important.
Well, thank you. I mean, you know, look, I'm a person of faith. You know, I'm a believing Muslim, and I do my best to practice, and I take people of faith very seriously, whatever faith they are. I mean, because in this world, you know, it's interesting. People ask me, okay, you know, you're an educated guy, 21st century, working in Hollywood, and you believe in God, and you know, that's how can you retain that in this world? And I said, you know, for me, there are many wonderful things that secular society offers. But one of the things that I think we as a civilization have perhaps lost sight of are the benefits of faith on a psychological level. You know, I think Carl Jung would have seen faith as a very important psychological tool for inner balance. And so that's what I wanted to explore in this book, is what faith means to the different characters. And they all have different perspectives. I mean, Saladin has a certain perspective. Richard has a perspective. But even amongst the Crusaders, I create the character of Sir William, who really has a perspective that most modern Christians would identify with. I think many modern Christians have a lot of difficulty identifying, and rightly so, with the Crusader mindset, which as being Christian. But as Sharon K. Penman, who's a superb author of this time period, actually she's working on a book right now on the Lionheart, as she once told me, she said, you know, these people authentically see themselves as Christians. That's how the Crusaders saw themselves. They didn't see themselves as going outside their tradition, even if they were killing women and children. They saw themselves as blessed by God. And most Christians today would have difficulty seeing it that way. So I had to create other Christian characters that perhaps reflect what I think is the heart of Christianity, and have those characters challenge the perhaps more power-oriented visions of faith. And finally, amongst the Jews, I think I did some more, because there's several Jewish characters, and I tried to look at the complexity of what believing in God means in that community, because, as you know, the Jewish community has a broad range. You can be a Jew and be an atheist, and you can be a Jew and be Orthodox, and there's a range, right? And so I wanted to look at those issues.
Well, and I thought that was, I think you've hit on something that's really important, of
mm-hmm.
course, and that is the conflict
mm-hmm.
in many believers
mm-hmm.
between their belief in their faith and what others in the same faith
sure.
profess, and that conflict exists in Christianity where you have perhaps, you know, the William kind of
mm-hmm.
Figure who is trying to live a spiritual and moral life,
mm-hmm.
but who finds himself in a position where he has to mm-hmm. kill people.
Sure.
And they have how do you resolve that conflict?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not clear that he actually succeeds.
Because I'm not sure it can be resolved. I mean, it's an issue that all of us who are sincere in faith struggle with, because the world isn't a peaceful place. It never has been. All of our religions were born into environments that were physically cruel and dangerous. You know, especially the biblical traditions. You know, nice biblical traditions, I include Islam, because it comes out of, as you know, the same world, Abrahamic tradition. And so both the Bible and the Quran appear in worlds that are incredibly primitive, incredibly violent, incredibly cruel, and they have to somehow propagate, the founders of these religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, have to propagate their beliefs in a very physically dangerous environment. And so all of the Bible has militaristic elements to it, the Quran has militaristic elements to it, but in my study of all these faiths, all of these elements of dealing with holy wars and military and fighting the name of God, these arise as defensive reactions to being attacked for first trying to spread an initially peaceful message. And that's the pattern of all three religions.
I know. It's such an interesting and kind of, you know, in some ways I find it very sad,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you have the message of the founders
mm-hmm.
of the three core religions of the Judeo-Christian Muslim tradition
mm-hmm.
are all espousing peacefulness, forgiveness, you know, inclusiveness, and there isn't that sense in the early stages of the religion that you have to kill anyone who is not in agreement.
Oh, no, not at all. What was happening is that their adversaries had that position. Whenever a new religious movement started, it was always critiquing the religious movement of the day, and whoever the power structure was of that religious movement would attack the new founder as a threat, and then would physically try to wipe out the communities. It happened in Judaism, it happened in Christianity, it happened in Islam. There is one difference, and I talk about it more actually in my first novel, A Mother of the Believers, which really deals with the birth of Islam. There's one historical difference that makes my discussion about religion a little more complex when I talk to my Christian friends. When I talk to my Jewish friends, they actually understand this. When I talk to my Christian friends, their view is, well, look, you know, Jesus never fought back. And that's the central vision of Christianity. Jesus never fought back, and he accepted what happened to him, and so without resisting. And so in that way, he is superior to someone like Muhammad, who did fight back. And my response is, well, Jesus and Muhammad are actually comparing apples and oranges because they're in different political structures. It's more relevant to compare Muhammad with Moses and David than it is with Jesus, because Jesus happens to be born in the middle of the Roman Empire in the Pax Romana. So there's a government, there's courts of law. They may be corrupt, but there are courts of law. There are soldiers in the streets. They may be oppressive, but they're still soldiers. Bandits are arrested, and so there is basic social order in the world of Jesus. That doesn't exist at the birth of Judaism or at the birth of Islam. Both of those religions happen to be born into completely primitive tribal desert worlds without government and without courts of law, without any sense of justice. And both of those religions, if you look, you know, people often compare elements of the Old Testament to the Quran. They both talk about harsh punishments and fighting those who fight you and all those things. It's because they were in this world where both of these religions had to preach a message of love at the same time as trying to establish a government in a very hostile environment where there's bandits and killers and murderers and rapists coming after you. And so that's really the different historical direction that the three religions took. And Judaism, Islam were just born into an environment where they physically had to create a state and as well as preach these ethical things. Jesus was born in an environment where there was a state in place.
Well, it's a different
historical development.
But of course, then, in maybe in the Christian and Muslim cases, maybe slightly more so than Judaism, the religion then becomes used by states as a kind of wraparound for imperialism.
Oh, absolutely, and you know, and I think it's true that post-Temple Judaism, it was no longer something that was even a practical idea. But it's very clear from the Hebrew Bible, the pre-Temple, that you know, everywhere from the period of Moses to the destruction of the Second Temple, that religion and state identity are intertwined, and that you have the same kind of politicians attempting to use religion to manipulate the masses.
Yeah, exactly.
When the Jewish community is scattered in the diaspora, then that's not even a practical consideration. Then it's surviving as a minority in other people's governments. Whereas you are correct that Islam and Christianity both became empires. And so as a result, they've had to face this consistent issue of people attempting to use the structures of their religion for their own power and purposes. And that's going on today in the 21st century.
Right, exactly. No, I think that's in many ways why your novel is so powerful, you know, that you were, you know, the setting and of the characters is hundreds of years ago, but there are very modern echoes to the things that are going on. And I thought, you know, in that way, really kind of made the novel much more interesting.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, because I, you know, obviously it's a big question.
Sure.
How your background is not in writing. You started, at least according to the biography of you that I've read, you have a couple of degrees that have nothing to do with writing, and then you became a journalist. So kind of maybe you could talk a little bit about how you made this leap from who you were at one time to who you are today.
Well, I think it's just about revealing who I was. I mean, I've always been a writer. I think most people who are writers know that they've been writers since they were children. I was writing short stories as fourth, fifth grade. You know, if Stephen King was once asked, why do you write? And he actually got angry when the journalist had asked him the question, and he looked at the journalist and said, "What makes you think I have a choice?" Because writing, in some ways, is a form of possession. Many writers, including myself, often don't want it because it haunts you. It doesn't let you stop. You know, it makes you wake up in the middle of the night and write because there is this force, this muse, whether it's a subconscious or whatever you want to call it, something that compels you to write. So I've been writing all since I was a child. I never initially thought that it would be a professional career because I thought, oh, it's a hobby. It's my passion or my compulsion, perhaps. But I will find practical things. I was a journalist for a few years. So I was able to make a little bit of a living off of at least writing in a reporting style, not necessarily fiction. And then I went to law school and business school and was going to go down a traditional Wall Street professional path. But the writing compulsion wouldn't stop. And when I was in graduate school, I wrote a screenplay, which ended up getting me an agent. And when I started selling screenplays in Hollywood, I said, okay, well, this looks like this is going to work. And so I moved out to Los Angeles 9 years ago, and I've been here since, writing professionally, which is really a blessing. I never imagined that I would be able to sustain myself for a decade without being, I have a law degree. I guess I'm technically still a member of the bar, but I haven't practiced in 9 years. This is my only source of income has been my writing, and I never imagined that. So that's a real blessing.
Yeah, that is. I think, in fact, for most writers, as you probably know, the vast majority of even professional writers aren't able to make a living.
Yeah.
So I think that's a pretty powerful endorsement of your abilities, I think.
Or so, my survival instinct.
Yeah. Well, now, do you write, are you still writing television and film? And also there's some mention of you working in video games. So are you kind of fluid in moving around to projects as they come, or are you particularly interested in one form over another?
Well, I mean, the great thing about being a writer is that there is actually always demand for your services, because everything in life is storytelling. Even if you're just creating a marketing presentation for selling widgets, you have to be able to tell a story. And so those who are good storytellers are actually able to captivate their audiences and make a point. And so there's always a market for that. Thankfully, I've been blessed in being able to write for television, for film, now for novels, and also for video games. I wrote a 50 Cent video game, Blood on the Sand, set in a fictional Middle Eastern country where he goes and has had some adventures. And so I'm delighted that I'm able to open these things, and I there may very well be other things I haven't even thought of yet that may come my way as my reputation increases. And that's how I got the video game. People heard about me from my television and movie work and said, okay, this guy, he's Muslim, he's a good writer, he understands our culture, and so we'll approach him. And so that's how opportunities seem to come. They seem to come when as my reputation increases. But I mean, my personal passion are these three elements, which is writing novels and screenwriting, and also I'm becoming a director. I directed a short film recently that did well, and I'm working on directing my first movie feature within the next few months, God willing. So I mean, Hollywood and publishing seems to be where my passion is.
Well, it's sort of, I'm interested in the video game thing, partially because I think for a lot of people, you know, particularly, you know, there are a lot of kids who don't necessarily read books, but who do play video games, and as you said, story is really the paramount marker. You know, it's what human beings are narrative beings. And so if you can tell a story, as you said, I think you can manage almost any form. But, I mean, do you see the video game arena as a place where you can maybe expand your horizon in the future, or is it just, you know, something that you did and maybe you'll come back to it another time?
Well, I mean, I would love to expand it more. I mean, right now I've got so much work in the television and movies and novel fronts that's keeping me busy, and I enjoy video games. You know, what I look for, if I were to write another one, I like creating worlds, and we did that a little bit in this 50 Cent game, because we were creating a fictional Middle Eastern country, we were creating a fictional conflict that he would have to get into. So I'm very good, I think, at creating worlds. And so the next video game that may come my way, I hope it provides me another opportunity, whether it's a science fiction game or a game set in the underworld against some monsters, that kind of thing. But where I add value is I think I'm able to take large ideas or large worlds and make them very believable to people today, and I think I've done that in everything I've done. So
what do you? I mean, that actually leads to another question. Do you think that would it be interesting to you to create a series of novels set in a fictional world where you can actually, you know, sort of like a lot of science fiction writers have created entire universes.
Sure.
And it gives them a lot of space to fill in. You know, you can kind of, as you've done with the Crusades, it's a kind of epic story where you can, I mean, you can go into the past or you can go into the future, but it would be interesting to create a multi-book world then.
Well, it's interesting because when I first toyed with the idea of writing a novel back in my early 20s, I'm in my late 30s now, but my early 20s, when I was still a reporter, when I hadn't even thought of going to graduate school or thought that I would ever be able to do this professionally and go to Hollywood, I started writing, and I'm sure somewhere in my notes I still have it, I started writing a fantasy novel. So, you know, because I've always been a fan of Tolkien and that world, and Guy Gabriel Kay, who wrote Tigana and other wonderful books, and Robert Jordan. So that sort of fantasy world I've always been fascinated by. So I had the idea, and God willing, perhaps one day in the very near future, I'll get back to developing it further, of creating a series of fantasy novels set in the ancient world of the Arabian Nights, taking that world of genies and Sinbad and Ali Baba and bringing them into the modern, Tolkien-esque type vision, which we haven't seen, and I don't think those exist yet. So God willing, I will work on developing those.
Well, that actually sounds pretty interesting. I mean, people often talk to me about ideas they have for books and worlds, and sometimes they sound good and sometimes they sound kind of dull, but that one actually I think you should really consider doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I started. I wrote a few chapters. I'll go find it. But it's been actually, maybe there's a reason you're bringing this up again cosmically, because it's begun to gnaw at me in recent days. It's one of those things where the compulsion begins, and then I wake up in the middle of the night going, okay, I'm going to have to write this pretty soon. But actually, if I can reveal to you, the book that I'm working on right now, my third book, will I think, I hope, stir some interesting discussion, just like the first two have. The next novel that I'm actually working on right now is actually about the birth of Christianity from the point of view of Jesus' immediate family. Yeah, because, you know, he has, according to the New Testament, and Catholics and Protestants disagree how to interpret it, but according to the New Testament, Jesus has at least four brothers and two sisters. And the Protestant tradition, that's understood to be literal other children of Mary and Joseph, whereas in the Catholic tradition, they're seen as cousins who are not, because Mary is a perpetual virgin in that tradition. And so But regardless, they were his immediate relatives, and they were very influential in the first century of Christianity. But for a lot of reasons, they have been erased from history, even though they are present in the New Testament. And Paul writes about them, and he defers to them on some level. And so it's really intriguing to resurrect those people, his immediate family members.
That actually does sound interesting and answers a question that I was going to ask, and that is if you worried at all about writing and sort of being typecast as a Muslim writer.
Oh, yeah, I have no desire of doing that. I mean, it's inevitable that at least in at this moment that people are noticing me, even the video game projects that came, were like, oh, you happen to be a Muslim writer, and we're sending this in that world. And so that's inevitable, but I have no intention of, no desire of, and certainly plan to make sure it never happens that I become that, the Muslim writer, because I care about the human condition, and I happen to be a practicing Muslim, but I actually know a lot about the world history and about world religions, and I care about them. And so it's very important for me to tell other people's stories. I mean, this book on Jesus' family, it'll be interesting because Jesus is a revered figure in Islam as well. But there won't be any technically Muslims there because it's six centuries before. but I think Muslim readers will appreciate my vision of Jesus, and I hope some Christians will as well. And so, But yeah, I mean, I definitely want to keep expanding, and another book that I plan to write, hopefully right after the novel on Christianity, is actually a vampire epic set in 19th century London.
Oh, this sounds really interesting. Well, it's I'm certainly intending to follow your next books.
Thank you.
And I will now go back and read your first one. I really want to thank you, Cameron, for talking to me. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Cameron Pasha, who's the author of a novel called Shadow of the Swords, an epic novel of the Crusades, a book that I really do recommend. I think it's a really entertaining but also complex and interesting book. Thanks so much, Cameron.
Thank you, David.